Good time. And the idea here is that one of the things that came out of the other sutta and comes out of actually everywhere in the suttas is the idea of how Siva, the idea of virtue, is the foundation of everything in the world. The more we are able to purify the virtue, the more we are able to deal with that, the more powerful human attachment starts to be. And of course, Siva, it involves, of course, verbal and bodily conduct. And I'm not going to talk so much about that now. Maybe I should, but I'm not going to do it anyway. It's another time now. But I'm going to go straight to the virtue of the mind. How to deal with the mind, how to overcome problems, defilements, and things of the mind. And of course, once you overcome the defilements of the mind, it also has an effect on your body and speech and everything. And it's really where the root problem is, and so it's very useful to deal with the mind. And there are a number of development pursuits on how to deal with this problem and how to overcome that. And this one I'm going to have a look at now is one of perhaps one of the most useful ones, both of five different ways of dealing with the defilements of the mind. And you can find them right there at the very beginning of the path. So this is really fundamental stuff to be able to get the meditation going. This is why I always emphasize these things. So this particular sutta is called the Sutta, the calming of the thoughts. Found in the Midland Sangs of the Buddha, Ajahnamagaya. And this is how it goes. So, that's how I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati, Jenka's Grove, and at Pindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus. And the sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the five mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs. What are the five? So here again we have this idea of the higher mind, the Adhicitta, which in the sutras always is a reference to Samadhi, specifically to the four jhanas that this is about. So anyone who is pursuing the jhanas is kind of attempting to move forward in meditation practice at the same time when it comes down to. From time to time we should attempt to find signs. And this word sign, Pali word behind this is nimitta. You may often have heard the word nimitta, people talk about samadhi nimitta and these kind of things. And the word nimitta, in most contexts, it means something like object of meditation, because samadhi nimitta is an object. Or the way often samadhi nimitta is used now is used like a light that appears in the mind as you get close to samadhi. But it's like an object in a sense. That is how it is used throughout the sutras. And here it is used almost like five signs, in a sense of five causes how to overcome the defilements. Five objects in the sense of causes for overcoming the defilements. This is what we mean in this particular context. Five ways, if you want to, of overcoming problems of the mind. So from time to time we should give to these five things. And as you will see here, when the Buddha talks the Dhamma, when he says five things, there is a particular sequence to these five things. That sequence is always important in Buddhism. This is one of the things people often forget. You read the sutra and you may see the five or this, the eight or that, or whatever. Whatever you see in a grouping like that, the grouping always has the same sequence in the sutra. Yeah, there's always five khandhas, five personality factors, has a certain sequence to it. It starts with form, then you have feeling, then you have perception, then you have volitional, intentional activities, then you have consciousness. And it's always the same sequence. And that sequence is never random. The sequence itself always has meaning, yeah? It would have the same thing, it's just in random sequences. Things come in a particular way. Eightfold Path, as I showed you before, it here has a sequence because each factor leads on to the next one. And it's always like five hindrances, yeah? The five hindrances are not kind of a random sequence. Some of those hindrances are more important than the other ones. Someone like subsidiary there. And here it is exactly the same thing. Everything what the Buddha teaches has to be graduated. So remember that, and when you remember that, it makes it easier to interpret the teachings correctly. Because then you understand why our structure is trying to see all of these things as sequential. And so what is important and what is not so important? What comes early, what comes late, and all these kind of things. So let's have a look at this fire. Why is that? And the first one, and it goes as follows. Here in Bhikkhu, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, owing to that sign, there arises in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion. And he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, and any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will and with confusion are abandoned in him and subside. Through the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steady internally, quieted, brought to singleness and still. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove and extract a coarse thing by means of a fine one, so too when the bhikkhu does all this, his attention to some sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and still. So here, you're giving attention to some sign. Again, sign here literally means some object, yeah? You're giving attention to a particular object, and while you are giving attention to that, these unwholesome defilements arise, yeah? So all these unwholesome things arise as you are doing that. So, you look at some person, yeah, and maybe you don't like the person, you're having some difficulty with them, yeah? And when you see them upset, arises, you get a bit angry, you get a bit ill will towards somebody, yeah? So that is arising owing due to that person, and this negative thing. Or you're sitting in this meditation, and you have some memory and some desire arises. Oh, I might have to do with some nice food or something like that. So desire arises about the counter or for any other reason. And this is basically all it means, that some object arises in the mind. Yeah? This is again the idea of sign here. It refers to an object. It doesn't necessarily refer to the object, it can also refer to a particular way of looking at that object. Because many of these things are not actually inherent in the object, but they are more to do with how we are looking at the object rather than actually being the object itself. There's different ways of looking at people, different ways of looking at food, yeah? If you've just eaten, the same food doesn't look very nice anymore, it's completely uninteresting yet. But if you're hungry, the food may look really, really nice. So it all depends on the circumstances, how you look at it. So, either in meditation, or outside of meditation, defilements arise connected with a certain thing. Then, when you give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, wholesome, then those bad, akusala, unwholesome thoughts, papakala, akusala thoughts connected with desire, etc., they are abandoned in him and they subside. So how does this work in practice? And it's actually very, very simple how this works in practice. So you see somebody here from the BGM, if you have anything that slam the door if you want, what? Can't do that, that's bad. On the tree, it's looking quiet. Or some silly little thing. Yeah, sometimes if you're in the wrong mood or whatever, small little things can just rise and spike in your attention. So then you remind yourself very quickly, actually the big picture here is so right, yeah, these people around me, this particular person, they're coming here on a meditation retreat, they're coming here to learn about Dhamma. They've got to be a really good person otherwise they wouldn't see here. People don't come to these kind of retreats. Yeah, you've got nothing to do here, what's the point of being here? If you're bad, and the pointless, you get to hear about all the stuff you don't want to hear about. So, you see the big picture, you remind yourself of all the good qualities in the people around you. They have good intentions. and keep pretense and trying the best of the time. Okay, maybe they lost a bit of mindfulness when they did something so right, but everybody does that every now and again, right? And then you shift your focus of that person away from the thing that's doing it, and you shift it to the big picture. You shift it to something beautiful that we know about that person already. Right? Such a simple thing to do, right? So, how can we do this? It sounds very easy when you hear that in theory, but in reality, of course, it is not always so easy. So, how can we do this? And particularly with certain people, it may be much harder. If you have known this for a long time, yeah, you really have to try really hard. You know, your family members, how can you have always positive perception of your family members? Much, much more difficult because you meet them all the time. Right? Yeah, so when you meet somebody rarely, it's easy. Yeah, but when you meet somebody kind of all the time, it's much more difficult. So how do you do that? Well, you have to actually train in your mind. You have to refocus on those good things again and again and again. This is often a great thing about going on a retreat. You go to a place like Jhana Grove, you come out of your ordinary circumstances and ordinary environment, and you go somewhere else. But because you are no longer surrounded by the ordinary input you get in ordinary life, it's a beautiful opportunity to learn, to look at things differently. Yeah, so you spend a bit of time. Now, okay, so what about my parents? Yeah, if you think back, and you. And you might think, actually, they did a pretty good job, but yeah, I did the best. But actually, you know, looking at how you kind of come out as a person, you know, you come out as a good and caring person who lives in a good way. Actually, that's done pretty well, my parents. So you look at the overall picture, and you remind yourself of all the trouble, all the things they have gone through, teaching you so much. They are your primary teachers, are your parents. Learning everything you know from when you were a child, yeah? Teaching everything, how to get dressed, how to go to the toilet, how to eat properly, yeah? These things are taught by parents, all the most basic things that are required to survive in this world that your parents have taught you. Yes, they aren't perfect. What do you think? People aren't perfect, that's the point. People are. And then once you start to get into this idea, this way of thinking about it, yeah? And you start to actually start to appreciate people. So you change your focus. You remind yourself of this again and again and again. Yeah? And as you do this, you are developing an alternative perception. And when the negative perception arises, you can switch very, very fast because of that. So this is a method, sometimes called the method of substitution. You substitute one point for another because you bad perception arrives, and quickly you shift your perception in another direction, and then you see the positive qualities instead. So you need to know yourself. What are the people in the world, or the situations in the world, where ill will or negativity often arises or can arise? Yeah? So your self-knowledge is a very important part of this. Knowing your weaknesses, knowing your strengths, and then dealing with those places that are weaknesses. And when you deal with those weaknesses, it tends to have a knock-on effect on all your perceptions. Because if you deal with the most difficult people in your life, then everyone else tends to kind of fall within that change of perception. And everyone else also is affected by that. And your view of the world changes dramatically. Or it changes dramatically over a long period of time. Where your perception becomes different. A very, very powerful way of doing things. With everything else, it takes effort, it takes perseverance, it takes commitment. And I think, as always, I always think the most difficult thing on the Buddhist path is that commitment and perseverance to the practice. You can't commit and persevere. It's amazing what you can do. You can do anything. You can change any perception. You can look at the world in any way you like. That is really the critical issue. And so if you have that commitment and perseverance, and I've already talked to you a lot about how to get that commitment and perseverance, I'll be talking about that maybe a little bit more again towards the end, because it's such a critical thing, then these things will happen, it will change. And you can do this during your meditation practice. Change your view, yeah? Change your swap the object out. Or you can do it in daily life, of course. Daily life is much more difficult because things happen so fast that you can certainly do it during your meditation practice. There's two ways of changing the attention to the sign. There's one way would be to actually change the object completely. I don't want to think about that person. I think about something else. Yeah? But much better than doing that is to change the way you are attending it to someone, because that actually changes your very approach to life. It changes something fundamental inside of you. How you look at the person is far more important than trying just to swap out and look at something else. So that is the first one. Yeah, the idea of substituting one way of looking for someone else. And then, if you are successful, and you will be if you keep on trying it, then what happens is that that thought subsides, and then your mind becomes steady internally, quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. So then the samadhi happens as a consequence. You abandon the bad thought. Once you have the good thought is actually quite easy to abandon. The defilement, which is the hard one, then the mind becomes still quite easily. Just as the carpenter can knock out, remove, and extract the coarse peg being the negative mindset, you extract that by means of the fine peg being the positive thought, that's in the fine thought. Because of that, you enter samadhi as a consequence. So this is the first of these five signs. And because it is the first one, it is the most important one. Most important is that it is the most powerful. If you do this, remember before we're talking about obliterating and annihilating, dispelling bad thoughts. This is how thoughts get obliterated, annihilated, and dispelled. This is how you do this. So if you would like those thoughts to completely disappear, this is the most powerful thing. And then comes the second one. And the second one is also very interesting and also very powerful. And this is a technique used by the Buddha himself and on his own path to awakening. It's going to appreciate some of your kind and also a bit of now. If while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him bad and wholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, with confusion, then he should examine this danger in those thoughts thus. Those thoughts are unwholesome, they are akusala, they are reprehensible, and they result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, and any bad and wholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion are abandoned in him and subsided. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a man, or just as a woman or a man, young, youthful, fond of adornments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around her or his neck, so too, when the bhikkhu examined the danger in those thoughts, his mind became steady internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and still. So if the first method does not work, it means that we have perhaps not tried hard enough yet to see the other side of the person, or perhaps we haven't actually properly understood the danger of saying this also. So then the alternative way is to actually see the danger in these thoughts. Thoughts connected with ill will and with desire and confusion. Why is it a problem? And this is really worthwhile investigating, because unless we understand the problems in these things, again, we will not really be motivated. We won't have the enough investment in actually trying to overcome these things. So this is another very useful contemplation, is to remind ourselves why these things are so problematic. And this is the Buddha's answer here to why these things are problematic. They are akusala. They are reprehensible, and they result in suffering. So this is one way of looking at this. Akusala, the Pali word, can be translated as wholesome. It can also be translated as unskillfulness. Yeah? So, and of course, all of that implies the idea that and also this means like sick of us, which likely is not very good, but also akusala, the idea of unskillful means that you're actually leading away from where you want to go. This is not suitable if you want to move towards Nibbana, you want to move towards more happiness, all of these things. So unwholesome has a sense of something that is slightly ill, slightly sick. And of course the Buddha, when you read the suttas, he said that ill will is anyone who has ill will is like a sick person. So mentally deranged at that point, you are slightly insane. Yeah, we don't feel insane when we get angry, but we feel fine. I must get angry to the right approach, now that's what it feels like. But from the Buddha's point of view, it's a mental illness to get angry. This is part of this akusala thing. It's reprehensible, I can't really remember the father behind this, I should have looked it up before I came in here. Presumably it just means something like that it is something which again has very negative consequences, and that's why it is reprehensible. In the last part here, it results in suffering here. And this I think is the most important thing here. If you look at the Madhyamaka number 19, the sutta which comes before this one, it's Vedavitaka Sutta. What it says, the Buddha says in there, when I understood that these particular thoughts leads to my suffering, the suffering of others, and to the suffering of both, then I abandoned these thoughts straight away. Yeah? Then they were annihilated, then they were obliterated, they couldn't exist. But this is part of the thing which is the most important thing to understand. If you really understand that these things are suffering, there is no way you're going to get into this. Yeah, it's back to the simile of the hot plate that I mentioned the other day. When you know it, when you put your hand on the hot plate by accident, you don't have to think, should I take it away or not? Just do it. You must take reaction. In the same way, if you understand that these thoughts are connected with suffering, they lead to suffering, the mind just turns away automatically if you have enough reflection in that area. So you need to understand this. So what is the problem with things like anger? Yeah, well, why is anger a problem? And it's not that hard to understand. Of course, anger leads to problems in our relationships. It leads to people around you. If you're an angry kind of person, it tends to people not really want to hang out with you. Yeah, and you become kind of persona non grata. Don't want to have anything to do with this person. It's unpleasant to be around people who get angry at you. People don't want to be with them. And you always have to be careful so they don't kind of blow up like a volcano or something like that. So that is very unpleasant. The more metta you have, the exact opposite of anger, people flock to you. People love people who are coming together. If you have lots of friends, then have metta. Exactly the word metta is derived from the word mitta, which means friend. So it actually means friendliness. It's one of the main meanings of this word. If you want to be popular, have as little anger and as much metta as possible. So it is so destructive for the world around us if we have anger. And of course, I think a lot of conflicts in the world, family life, work, even big conflicts between nations, very often are often rooted in this sort of defilement. Yeah, too much negative perception, too much anger, too much of this kind of stuff creates endless kind of problems. So, the more important than that is to remember that if you want to have success in your meditation, even if a little bit of anger is going to be very problematic. If you want to move forward on the Buddhist path, then you have to get rid of this as much as possible. And if you understand that the Buddhist path and practice is the actual meaning of life, this is where you find real purpose and existence. Anger is going to be a massive problem for that. It's going to destroy your ability to a large extent to move forward on the path. Not just that, but if you don't move forward on the path, then eventually this anger is going to cause tremendous problems for you in the future. The anger is a habit that you carry into this life, coming from past lives. That habit you will take to this life, also into future lives. Yeah? And then you come under maybe the wrong kind of guardianship or the wrong influence in the future life, and anger is going to blossom going to flare up and get much worse. And before you know it, you're going to do all kinds of crazy things as a consequence of your of these things. Now we have the opportunity to deal with it. Just no way to know how these things are going to turn out in the future, how they're going to end up in future existence. Once you understand how these habits carry on from life to life, it's actually quite scary now. Because you don't really know what you're doing. It just carries on. Yeah? You feel that you are in charge of this, and you're not really in charge of it. This habit's carrying on from one existence to the next one. And then, given the right goals and conditions, things kind of turn out incredibly bad as a consequence. This long-term view of what happens with these departments is actually very, very concerning. Now is the opportunity to deal with it. Now you take your chance. And remember, every time you kind of get a bit angry, you're taking one step backwards on the path. You're reinforcing that habit of being. So it becomes such almost like a matter of life and death. Every moment, you kind of be very careful. Have that yogi somasikara, the wise attention, whereby you're always aware of what you're doing. And you steer away in the right moment, yeah? Because you know this is going to take me backwards. I have no time to go backwards on the path. My life is so short. There's so much to be done. Yeah, I don't know, but you've not been in one for 20 years. I was like, Jesus, I've been in one for 20 years. I get my act together. That's what I often think. Yeah. 20 years, and I'm kind of, I think I've been a reasonably good man for those 20 years. Still, there are kind of more things to be done there. It's not that if this path doesn't happen like that. It is gradual. Every moment matters. Every chance, every mind moment is an opportunity to either move forward, to stand still, or to move backwards. And if you don't take every opportunity to move forward, you're not going to get that. You're not going to get very far. So after a while, you start to understand this is kind of so significant, matters so much. Take the opportunity now, or it will never come back to you again. So in this way, by understanding this in the right way, one of the similes that the Buddha used in the sutra, he says that you should view this as if your hair is on fire, or your turban is on fire. Yeah, if your turban is on fire, what are you going to say? Or your hair is on fire? Oh yeah, there's fire, there's chill, yeah, there's matter, people kind of... You're going to get desperate, yeah, your hair is on fire, or okay, I better do something very, very quickly, yeah. Otherwise, that's going to be the end of me, yeah. So you do something very fast. And exactly the same way, this defilement is like having your hair on fire. You do something now, and now is the opportunity, yeah. That is what this really means. seeing the danger of these things, seeing how, unless you take the opportunity now, it may come back. And it's not just bad for you. If you are a compassionate kind of person, you're concerned about other people as well, then how anger affects the people around us in the world very badly as well. That affects all of us badly, yeah? So it has very bad consequences. Of course, it is also for desire and for confusion. For desire, I will talk a little bit more about that later on, but the most important thing is to deal with the anger. The desires, okay, you can deal with that a little bit as well, but the anger is really the most important one. Buddha says specifically that anger is much to blame, and it's also relatively easy to deal with. It's not that easy, yeah, it's still kind of hard work, but it's relatively easy. It's more easy to deal with the sensual desires, which is even more easy. And the confusion and the delusion, they both blameworthy and difficult to deal with. But by dealing with the anger, you're already dealing with the confusion and delusion to some extent, because these things are linked to each other. Okay. So, and then the Buddha also says in this other sutra, which I, in Majjhima Nikaya, he says that these negative thoughts, they are pandya nirodhika, which is the cessation of wisdom. They are painful, something like that. They are painful in the present moment, yeah? And they are unpleasant, I think he said that there, yeah? But pandya nirodhika, when you're angry, you have no wisdom anymore, yeah? So be careful. Remember that. It's a very nice thing to remember, because when you get upset, the power of anger is to say, act now. That's what anger says to you. It compels you almost to act. When you get upset, you really want to act. This person needs to be told off or something like that. Yeah? So it's a very compulsive force inside of you that causes you to act very fast. The same thing with desire also can be a very compelling force inside of us. So, but remember, according to the Buddha, when you have anger, you have no wisdom. Hanyavironika, because you have no wisdom, you don't know what you're doing. Acting blindly, yeah? So very often, if you feel strong defilements in your mind, wait. Don't do anything. Relax. Wait till you overcome that defilement. Then, when the defilement is overcome, that is the time to make decisions, whether they are small decisions or large ones. So, because there's nothing. At that time, you are blind, basically. It's painful. Anger is not only the dukkha in somebody causes something in the future, but actually it's painful right now. Why is that so hard to see? And the reason why it is often hard to see is because instead of focusing on the feeling of anger, when you're angry, you focus on the object. Yeah? You see the person, because you see the person all the time, but you see the person as an object, and then you that kind of externalize everything. Yeah? This, and then the when you feel the anger inside, instead the focus is on that person that makes you angry. Yeah? And then because of that, your anger is justified. If you turn the tables a little bit, and instead you feel what the anger feels like, yeah, forget about the person or whatever makes you angry. Feel the anger. And actually, you'll notice that actually it's not very nice. Anger as a feeling is not, it feels burning, it feels hot, it's very agitated, yeah? It's not peaceful at all, it's restless, it has all these negative qualities to it. So try it, instead of looking out at the object, try to feel what it feels like. And when you feel what it feels like, you think, well, this is what it feels like, gee, person. Why am I getting angry? This is madness. It's just destroying my own life. So it's painful now, and it's bad karma for the future, and it creates all these problems for everybody else as well. After a while, you realize this is not worth it. Yeah, this is really silly. So you try to calm down. You try to change your perception in this way. And when you understand this, you have the motivation to change your perception of to change your mind and to look at things in a different way. Getting that motivation is so important, and then things kind of start to look differently as a consequence. So, but reflect on these things, yeah? Think about them for yourself. One thing is what I'm saying here now, one thing is what the Buddha says. But when you reflect on this and you make it your own wisdom, that's when it becomes powerful. And everybody has slightly different ways of dealing with these things, yeah? Everybody has slightly different approaches. So you find your approach to these things. And your approach is going to be the most powerful one for you, because that is what works for you. So, remember that. Okay. So, the same thing is true for desire and ill will as well. Now, you have this beautiful little simile here, yeah? I don't know if you find it beautiful, but certainly powerful. Just as a young woman, actually the party has woman first, but they have changed around to man and woman, actually have a woman or man. Young, youthful, fond of ornaments, they will be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a dead snake, dog, or human being were hung around his or her neck, her or his neck. How would you feel if you get a dead dog hung around your neck? Yeah? Not one that was just dead, but one that had been dead for a while, yeah? How would you feel that? Would you be happy about that? If you said, yeah, whatever, I'm pretty chill, you know, it's just a matter, yeah? Would you be kind of relaxed about that? Or would you feel, what? This is terrible, man. And this, of course, obviously, if you have old, especially old carcass, something that is kind of rotting already, and sitting on, you know, in Buddhism, you have a charnel ground contemplation, yeah, with a corpse that is kind of getting bloated and all these kind of things. It's disgusting very, very quickly if you see a corpse, something that is dead. One of the great things about being a Buddhist monk, I don't know if you think this is great, this is one of the, I think it's really great, that you see animals in the forest dying all the time, yeah? And animals in the forest, when they die, it is not a pretty sight, I can assure you. So we have all these kangaroos, yeah, and you think the kangaroos maybe, I don't know what you think about kangaroos in Malaysia, but usually outside of Australia, you think, oh, kangaroos are so cute, yeah, oh, very, very cute, furry, kind of look kind of nice, yeah. But the closer you are to nature, the less cute nature becomes. And this is the weird thing about nature, especially the animal world. It has so much suffering. There's so many problematic things with the animal world. And the kangaroos, you'd be surprised how much aggression there is in the kangaroo. Yeah? If you have a nice piece of chocolate cake and you give that to the kangaroos, there is going to be a fight over that chocolate cake. Yeah? And guess who wins? The biggest one always wins. And it chases away the small ones. So the small ones, tiny little kangaroos, yeah, even more cute, they get chased away by the big ones. So it's terrible. And this is how it works. Greed and anger kind of working in conjunction. But the worst part is when they die. Yeah, the kangaroos die, just like all beings. And then they get so, it is such a terrible stench, yeah, the kangaroos die. It's so terrible. There's maggots come literally overflowing with maggots everywhere. The stench is unbearable. And gradually, kind of, it shrinks. The whole kangaroo starts to shrink till everything gets eaten and the corpse is kind of left behind it. And it looks quite terrible. I wouldn't really recommend it to anyone. This is probably what is meant here by Christ. I just want to make it kind of, you know, vivid what is going on when the Buddha says these things. The Buddha doesn't usually beat around the bush. That is the idea. So it feels like, you know, you have a carcass slung around your neck. Yeah, a dead carcass. Is that how you feel when you feel the thought of anger or desire, or you are confused, you feel like this kind of carcass around your mind in a sense. We don't usually feel that, yeah? And the reason we don't feel that is because our perception of these things are not the same as the Buddha's perception. But from the Buddha's point of view, this is what it is like. Yeah? So you need to develop a little bit of that carcass perception, yeah? So whenever you feel angry, especially with anger, you have this feeling that this actually, this is not worthy of me to have this kind of thoughts. Yeah? This is just like I'm walking around in KL with a dead snake around me. Yeah? And the same kind of thing. Yeah? And once you get that feeling, you get this feeling of being disgusted about it. No, this is the wrong way. This is the wrong path. This is so problematic. Yeah? So if you can build this up, it starts to become very powerful. So it is worthwhile, you know, when you read this kind of synonyms, don't think that they are there for no reason. These symbols are there precisely because the Buddha is trying to drive home a very powerful message. These things are a bit like carcasses of donkey snakes. Yeah? This is not a haphazard kind of illustration. This is a real problem. That's what the Buddha is saying here. Yeah? So a very, very powerful simile, and I think it's very useful to reflect on them and see them a little bit like that. Yeah? And then, of course, as you do that, you see the problems with this, you start letting it go, and then again, second method, then your mind is brought steadily, steadily, quietly, brought to singleness, and still as a consequence. That is the second most powerful method, and in many ways, these two first methods, they go together to some extent, because when you learn the second method, you're also enabling the first method. It makes it easier to substitute the thoughts if you understand the danger. Yeah? So the second method here is like enables the first method as well. So both of these are very useful together. Let's have a look at the three remaining methods. They are, in my opinion, not as useful, but sometimes you have to use these things because you're not ready for the first two ones, perhaps. If, while you're examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in that person bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion, then you should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, the mind becomes steadily eternally, quietly drawn to singleness and still. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that have come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadily eternally, quietly drawn to singleness and still. So here, all you are doing is that you just keep you don't attend to what is happening. You don't attend to those thoughts. And a typical example here would be while you are sitting during your meditation practice, yeah, and perhaps you are attending to the breath or attending to something, and for some reason some anger or negativity arises in your mind. When that anger and negativity arises with your mind, it's like you just ignore it and you just go stay with the breath, yeah? And that anger and negativity may still be in the background, but because your main attention is on the breath, because your main focus is on that, it's as if the anger is kind of irrelevant. And gradually it just disappears again afterwards. So you stay with what you're doing. In daily life, it may be that you are doing something at work or whatever, and some kind of negative thought arises. And you just place your attention back on what you're doing, whatever it is that you're doing. Yeah, or you are at home doing some household chore, just stay with the household chore, whatever it is that you're doing. So you just place your attention on something else, and then that anger may subside, because after a while it kind of loses its grip, and it may just disappear. But you can see why this method is quite a lot weaker than the previous ones. And the reason is because with this method here, the anger can re-arise again very quickly because you haven't really countered the anger. Yeah? With the previous methods, what you have done is you have actually chosen a different perception and seeing the object in an entirely different way, either by seeing the danger or by seeing the positive side of the object. That has a massive power because it actually is almost like it is countering the anger with the exact opposite perception. So that destroys the anger in a much more powerful sense, and it eliminates it in a much more powerful way. And that is why this is called the obliteration and the removal, annihilation of the anger. Right, so this method, you're not actually annihilating everything. The anger may still arise very quickly again, and that's why this method is much weaker. So sometimes in your meditation practice, this may be good enough, because sometimes a very weak form of ill will may arise, so you just leave it to one side, and you stay with the breath, and it disappears afterwards. This is where you need to experiment a little bit in your own life, with your own meditation, with your own daily mind, to see what actually works for you. And you will see certain things work at certain times, and other things work at other times. And then you have this arsenal of countermeasures that you can use. When these things happen, it's like this. No, I don't really like the war metaphors are no good. I think they're too violent, especially the war metaphors actually. But just allow things to have an arsenal of thoughts, and good thoughts. Okay, so that is this one here. Just like the person looking away, you're looking in different direction. And sometimes that can be good enough. If you see someone coming, you don't really want to talk with them because you don't feel right, you're just going to look in a different direction, you walk off in a different direction before they get too close, so they don't really have a chance to influence you in a negative way. That can be enough. So that is number four. Let's now move to number five. Number four. If one is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, they still arise in him bad and unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion, then he should give attention to the stilling, the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to the stilling and the thought formation of those thoughts, and any bad and wholesome qualities that are thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with illusion are abandoned and subside. With the abandonment of them, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. So he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. And he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that is more subtle. So too, when the bhikkhu gives attention to the stilling, the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steady internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and still alone. So what does this mean then? Is it not quite as obvious, yeah, and what is happening here? What does it mean to still the thought formation? And the Pali word here, I think it's vitakka, or something like that. And what the meaning here is simply that the thought formation, in other words, that creates the thought. I don't think this is very well translated, actually. It's better to translate it as the stilling of the volition to think, or the will to think, the stilling the will, or stilling the intention to think, maybe even. And so what you're stilling is the thing that drives the thinking forward. What is that drive the thinking forward? Well, it's actually your will. You want, as I said the other day, you want to think, that's why you think. Yeah. It may not be obvious because it's such a simple thing happening in our minds, but you actually want to think. Yeah. So what you do is you withdraw the wanting, you withdraw the volition, the will that drives the mind forward. Yeah. How do you do that? And the way to do that, remember, a lot of meditation is often taught to be the passive observer, yeah, to be like a passenger while you're meditating. Yeah. So you're sitting back and just observing it. Yeah. And the more able you are to be a passive observer of what is happening, yeah, what actually being involved in thinking mind, yeah, the more that stronger that ability is, the more the thinking will actually tend to die down by itself. The thinking is the most strongest. If you have no perception that you are thinking, the thinking is just running on, and you are kind of in the middle of the stream, and you're part of the thinking process. At that point, you have no ability to stop it, because you are in the middle of the stream, running along with it. But once you become mindful that you are thinking, wait, what I'm thinking, at that moment, the thinking is already slowing down quickly. Because that awareness means you're stepping back, you're no longer involved in the process. And at that moment, the will, the input to drive this process forward is already fading away. So the more you're able to stand back and just watch the process of thinking, the stronger your mindfulness is, the more ability you have to stand back like that. The less fuel you are producing for the thinking process. And this is the whole idea of being the passive observer in meditation, yeah? Just passively standing back, watching the whole process going on. It's not easy to do that. It's not easy to be entirely passive. You're not usually used to that. But it's really, really worthwhile trying to do this in our meditation. And you find your mind becomes peaceful very quickly if you have that ability. Choiceless observation, you're just aware of whatever's happening. There is no such thing as choiceless observation, but it feels a bit like that. You stand back, you allow things to be there. Passive observer, as little involvement as possible. And as you do that, your mind goes from running to walking, from walking to standing, from standing to sitting down, and eventually your mind is just really relaxed, lying down. This is why the lying down meditation symbolizes this particular way of doing or thinking about things, or not thinking about things. So this is how this works. So, and this is why being a passive observer actually is a useful way of doing the meditation as well. But again, it is not very powerful. It is not very valuable because it doesn't really overcome the root of the problem. And you haven't really shifted your perception, and it can re-arise again very quickly. So it's up to each one of us to know when to apply which method. And the first methods, again, are the more powerful ones, but these other methods also have the right time for using. So, that one, then we come to the last one then. This is the really the natural way of overcoming that concept. If, while he's giving attention to the stilling of the will to think, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, connected with ill will, and with confusion, then, with his teeth clenched, and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Remember this phrase? We had this phrase before, because we were from the beginning. We were looking at Madhyamalikaya 36, when the Buddha used this method before his awakening. And there, it was the wrong path. Yeah? Remember that? It was crushing. It was one of the ascetic practices, a self-tormenting practice that he used before his awakening. He tried to find awakening, and it didn't work out. And here it is included in the five ways of overcoming unwholesome thoughts. So remember, this is generally, this is wrong path, generally speaking. This is kind of the first thing. That's why it's found in that part of the ascetic practices. That's why this is number five on the list here. You're really desperate. And you hit just one stone, and you, maybe you are about to do something really bad as a consequence. Occasionally, this is the right way to do things, yeah? You crush minds and mind, you really just suppress it. This is what we mean by suppression. Yeah? And of course, suppression can very often lead to psychological imbalances. If you have a very suppressed memory, suppressed all kinds of things, and they are coming back from your mind, we're always holding them down. And it can lead to instability in your personality. It can lead to insanity sometimes with too much suppression. So it's not a very good way of dealing with things, except in very dangerous situations where these things can overcome you very powerfully. So use them very carefully. Problem with most human beings is that we tend to use suppression first, yeah? Because suppression, we know what to do. Yeah, we're kind of used to this. We're used to bullying our mind around a little bit. Don't think that. Think about this. This is wrong, yeah? And you kind of crush it down, all these kind of things. This is how we're used to using willpower. Yeah? So we use that willpower also in our meditation practice. So for this reason, it's actually important to remember that this is a very last thing we should do. Use less of it. Be more gentle with ourselves. And as we are more gentle with ourselves, we actually find that a lot of the defilements kind of almost evaporate. Because if we are harsh on ourselves, the defilements often come along together with our harshness. If you are kind to yourself, if you are gentle, then there is less problems in the first place. Yes, the defilements will stick in the end. There's something beautiful in that. If you are harsh with yourself, just suppress things. You don't really have an opportunity to look at yourself carefully and investigate what's going on there. But if you are gentle and you just stand back, you watch what is going on there, you watch the process of that also rising there, that is when you can have some clarity on what's going on there. Yeah? You see the causality, you see how certain perceptions lead to anger, lead to desire. You see the process, you start to understand yourself. You start to understand your own conditioning, yeah? And then you can kind of be cool about it. You can analyze it with coolness instead of being emotionally involved. And once you get emotionally involved, it's actually very hard to analyze things in a cool way. That mind will stand back and just watch it and sees things very coolly. It's a very useful mindset to have. So if you are harsh with ourselves, then very often you don't see things very clearly. You think, no, I shouldn't do that. It's like automatic reaction. And there is no insight, no clarity at all because of that. So much better to be cool. Yeah, but this is the way I am. It's okay to be like this. It's okay to get upset every now and then. Everybody does that. This is the human conditioning. It's okay to have these desires coming up every now and again. Confusion, of course you get confused every now and again. This is just life, or deluded even. It has to be like this. There's nothing to be upset about. It's a miracle. I'm not more angry. That's the real miracle, yeah. So hooray for the fact that we're getting more angry then. Yeah, you see that in a positive light. And you're kind of happy with yourself for the positive things that you see there. And then you have the right attitude. And then you can kind of analyze the situation clearly. And then you can take the counteractive measures, understand what it is that you have to do. So use this method very carefully. Use it as little as possible. Probably you may very well be using it already in daily life. Yeah? Because it's kind of how we are. You don't want to see that thought, okay, push it aside. This is how things often work. So when with his teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he feeds down and strains and crushes mind with mind, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with hate, with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steady eternally, quieted, drawn to singleness and stilled. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head and shoulders and beat him down and strain him and crush him, so too, and when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, the bhikkhu beats down and strains and crushes mind with mind, then your mind becomes steady internally, quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. So quite a kind of a violent metaphor there. I have to finish this thing off. So that is kind of part of the problems they had. So anyway, so that is those other five methods. And please keep in mind that these are sequential. The most powerful ones here are the first two. The two next ones can also be used occasionally in your meditation when you find it works out. And the last one used with care, because it should be the very last resort. And the last paragraph, the bhikkhu. When the bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign, there arrive in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected to desire, hate, and illusion. Then, when he gives attention to some other signs connected to what is wholesome, those bad, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside. And then his mind becomes steady, eternally quiet, and draws stillness. First man, then you see the danger in those thoughts, and you try to forget those thoughts, not give attention to them. And then the last, fourth one, you give attention to the stilling of the thought formation. In other words, you just have a passive observer, you become the passive observer of those thoughts. And then finally, when your teeth clench and your tongue pressed against the roof of your mouth, you beat down those thoughts, you crush them, and hopefully I guess eventually, I don't think your mind becomes very easily concentrated or still when you do that. Maybe eventually down the road it may be, but initially I think this method often can take a while before your mind kind of comes together after that. This then is called the monk who is a master of the course of his thoughts. So whatever thoughts you wish to think, you will think it. And you will not think any thought you do not wish to think. Yeah, you become the master of your mind. You become the mastermind. And being a mastermind is very useful then. And you think those thoughts you want to think, you don't think anything you don't want to think. But handy, yeah. You're no longer this slave of your past conditioning, is what this means. Because if you don't want to think a thought, but you still think it, it's because the conditioning is stronger than you are. And you are a slave to your conditioning. You're like a robot running on a program written in the past. Moving forward like a zombie, thinking this, thinking that. Oh no, no, it doesn't matter, the program is stronger than you, you're going to think this regardless. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? The very fact, the very idea that it's possible to think whatever you want to think, always think the right thing, even that possibility seems remote to most people. How can that possibly be then? But actually, Buddha says it is possible. And the very last sentence there, I'm not going to read it out because it doesn't really belong there. He has severed craving from all perspectives. This is basically the ending of the path. You become an arahant, but you don't become an arahant just because you control your thoughts. So it is interesting that in the Chinese version of this sutta, that line is not there. So presumably it has been added at some stage during the transmission of the Pali Sutta. I think the Chinese version is much more likely to be original or authentic. So that that last line, I think, probably doesn't belong there. But the very last line probably does belong. That is what the first one said. The figures were satisfying and united in the blessed one's words. Okay, so that is it. And if you have any questions about this sutta, please ask this evening. And when I come back next year, I will test you out if you have succeeded in answering one of your thoughts. Anyway, that's all for now. And let's see if you can ask us for today.
Sad.